Hi there, friends, and welcome to the Belgian Waffle Ride podcast. My name is Jim Miller, and I am your host for this episode as we kick off our 2022 series of conversations with many of the top athletes, personalities, brands, and people, both in front of and behind the scenes, that all go into making the BWR the event that it is. We're just a few weeks away from launching our 2022 race series with the big one, the OG, our San Diego event, which will be held the weekend of April 29th through May 1st, and contended on a course that is perhaps the most devious we've ever created. And it's because of all that that we wanted to lead with our guest today, who is none other than the owner, founder, and chief evangelist of Hammer Nutrition, Brian Frank. Hammer's been with BWR for a few years now, and we couldn't think of a better partner to have when it comes to the fueling and hydration needs that exist for someone trying to tackle the BWR. This conversation isn't just a straight brand play, though, as after a brief introduction on Brian's background and how he founded the company, we go really deep into strategies and techniques for proper fueling and hydration for anybody who expects to finish the BWR. We talk in depth about common mistakes people make before and during the event and how to avoid them, the importance of post-race recovery, and even get into deciphering some of the misconceptions on how to prepare your body for a big endurance effort. There's even a little Easter egg late in the episode about what he treats himself to after he completes one of his many efforts in the hobbies and sports that he pursues. I've known Brian for a number of years, and you'll not find a more passionate or knowledgeable person anywhere in the industry when it comes to understanding how the body works and building products that supports optimum performance through hydration, nutrition, and supplements. He's a fascinating guy with a massive amount of info that you can learn from in order to have the best possible ride at the BWR, regardless of your level or ability. Please enjoy our conversation with Hammer Nutrition's Brian Frank.
I've got some great experience with Hammer even long before I knew you. In my early in my riding career, I found Hammer, and I knew right away it worked because it worked. You know, I didn't have any of the problems and the issues that all the other products and stuff gave me. So it's great now to come to this part of my life and be able to work with you as a brand and have you guys as a big part of Belgian Waffle Ride. So appreciate you making the time and sitting down with us here today.
Thank you, Jim. It's good to be here. And it's interesting now after doing this for 35 years, how many people I come across where there was a previous, you know, touch point, you know, years or decades previously. And, you know, then we find ourselves in the same room together today. So that's all part of this awesome adventure that I've been on.
Well, and let's go back to the beginning of that adventure. I any good story starts at the beginning, right? I know a little bit about it, but I want to hear it unfold. You have probably what a lot of people would consider a maybe untraditional upbringing and background. Tell us a little bit about that. How did it all start? What were the formative years of young Brian Frank like?
Yeah, I think that's probably an understatement. I think most of it falls under the into the category of you can't make this stuff up. and the reason I think it's also worthwhile, you know, when we start the story of Hammer and the products, to know where my background is and where I grew up and how different it was. Not the same experience I think most people had in the 60s and 70s, even in Southern California. So the story goes, I was born in the Hollywood Hills in Laurel Canyon in March of 1967. At home, no doctors, just my dad, my two sisters, and we didn't go to doctors. You know, my dad was into supplements and nutrition and was studying to be a chiropractor. My mom was into homeopathy and natural remedies and training as a midwife. And so, you know, if I scraped my knee, you know, I was putting calendula on it, not Neosporin, and I was taking Arnica tablets, you know, not something else. We took vitamins and supplements at meals. I can remember being 4 or 5 years old and, you know, taking my vitamin C and my other vitamins and things. Granted, it wasn't about eating your vegetables because that was mostly what we were eating anyways. So just like with my kids, and when I was a kid, you know, my mom said, picky eaters go hungry around here. You don't like what we're having for dinner, you don't have to eat it. But that's as far as it goes. Right. So I grew up granola before it was trendy or cool. And I can tell you right back then, eating gluten-free and sugar-free and stuff in the 70s, it wasn't exactly like it is today. Yeah. Those wheat-free carob chocolate chip cookies that my mom used to make were more like hot pucks, you know. I think we threw them around at people more than we ate them.
Right.
But the point was, is, you know, from the time I was 5 years old, I was taught, you know, in fairly, you know, stark terms about what to eat and what not to eat. And, you know, my mom would say, no white death in our house. And she's referring to refined sugars, dairy, and grain products.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a big stretch when I decided to go into this nutrition business to see where we'd be pivoting from and what the underlying philosophy for the products would be. And I think that's entirely unique in terms of any of the nutrition brands you see in the market today, because every product that you find in the Hammer line is consistent with my beliefs and philosophies on whole food diets and nutrition from when I was small growing up. And again, to this day, our design criteria does not allow for the development or the introduction of products that do not fit within that paradigm. So you're never going to find a Hammer product that's, you know, full of artificial colors, sweeteners, flavors, and sugars, and trans fats, and emulsifiers, and all the guar gums, and carrageenan, and all these other things that you find so often in prepared packaged foods, and especially in sports nutrition products.
Yeah.
I've been telling people for decades that an athlete shouldn't have to go on a junk food binge just because they want to do a triathlon or a gravel ride or a trail race or something. So growing up granola gave me a pretty much a running start on the whole nutrition thing.
A lot of kids might rebel against that, though, when they get a little older, or even get out on their own and stuff like that. But you managed to stick with it.
And that's you're entirely correct, Jim. Some of us more than others. You know, in my three kids, you know, all three of them grew up very similar diet and lifestyle. And two out of the three have maintained their, you know, their diet and practices and things. One of them, you know, we'll say she's a little off the reservation. But she still knows the difference. And that's what I'm usually really trying to, you know, talk to clients about in this day and age is, you know, just be honest with yourself. Okay. Don't be eating candy saying this is athletic fuel, or any of the other stories we tell ourselves to justify the things we eat. I mean, if you're eating vegetables, that's probably good. If you're eating things that come in boxes and packages and have 37 ingredients, that's probably not good.
Yeah, and an OUSE or something like that, right?
Right, all the OSEs and all of the... So the idea is, and this is why, you know, our fueling philosophy that I've distilled over the past 3.5 decades in business and then prior in my athletic career in high school and college and what... is less is best. It's really simple. And in most instances, when an athlete is encountering difficulties, if they would do less, things would go better. Less intervention, less help. Because in the scheme of things, when you're talking about life and death survival, doing a 120-mile gravel ride or an Ironman triathlon or a 100-mile trail race isn't that big a deal. And I say that knowing full well that people are listening going, wait a second, this is really hard.
Right.
Okay, but as long as you don't do really stupid things, it's not a life or death situation. Your body is not trying, you know, with everything it can to propel you. So the idea is if we just let our body do what it's naturally programmed to do and wants to do, and we add in just as much assistance as it needs and can benefit from in the way of calories, fluids, and electrolytes, you generally have a good day.
Did what ultimately became some of your first products start with your own tinkering around to fuel yourself in your athletic pursuits as a younger guy?
Absolutely. The first product that I marketed in 1987 was a high-potency CoQ10 supplement called Race Caps. The key ingredients, coenzyme Q10, vitamin E, and inosine, I had been using in my high school athletic career and collegiate career, swimming, playing water polo at Wilson High School up in Long Beach, and that was cross-training for racing motocross Wednesday night at Ascot, Thursday night at Orange County International Raceway, and then Saturday, Sunday at, you know, Barona Oaks, Saddleback, Carlsbad, or whatever track I could get to. So training 5-6 hours a day, maintaining a 3.8 GPA in honors classes, working 2 or 3 jobs, racing weekends. I don't know how I did it,
right?
But I can tell you right, there was a lot of supplements involved. Like I say, I was, you know, keying on those three, the Race Caps ingredients, but then I was also taking, you know, a lot of vitamin C and all of the other supplements that I had grown up taking, and protein. Let's be reminded that back in the 80s, conventional wisdom being propagated by, you know, people with a lot of learned knowledge, degrees behind their and letters behind their name, were saying, if you're an endurance athlete, protein is irrelevant. Just carbs. You're burning carbs, so you need to eat carbs. And if you get too much protein, you'll look like a bodybuilder and you'll be all muscle bound and you'll be slower, you know, swimming, biking, and running. So we had people not only neglecting basic protein requirements, but actively avoiding it. Meanwhile, they're just mainlining carbs. I mean, I had clients in the beginning who were telling me that they'd go out for an hour and a half for a 2-hour run and come home and eat a loaf of bread. So I wasn't doing that. I was eating a lot of protein, a lot of vegetables. And of course, you know, when you're 16, 17, 18, and training that much, as much of everything else as I wanted. But the grains and starches is rice and potatoes and occasionally grain, you know, wheat products like a sandwich or spaghetti or something. Unfortunately, a lot of my early customers, the people who first got into the triathlon craze in the 80s, mid 80s, late 80s, after they saw Julie Moss crawling across the finish line at Ironman on, I think it was the 85 or 86 Wide World of Sports presentation.
Yeah.
You know, and they're like, yeah, that. And back then we called them yuppies, and there were no computers or PDAs. So you had a day planner, right? You had your day planner and you're driving a Saab or a BMW, and you've got every waking moment from 4 a.m. until 8 or 9 p.m. scripted, and there's a workout before work, and there's a workout at lunch, and there's a workout after work. And you know, you're supposed to be the fittest person in the world, and yet your immune system is tanking, you're getting sick every other week. You've got these porpoising, you know, blood sugar levels, and you're, you know, bonking in the middle of the day if you don't eat every 2 hours. It was strange times,
and you're moody as hell, and sure, grumpy, and then happy, and then grumpy again.
And, you know, then comes insulin resistance, and then comes, you know, type 2 diabetes. And, you know, that's the sad part is, you know, the high carb, low fat diet craze. It might have reduced cardiovascular disease a little bit, but the metabolic dysfunction that it caused in terms of pancreatic and insulin function, unbelievable. So now we know more. We're smarter.
Were you, yeah, in a way, yeah, you were bucking both the current medical knowledge at the time, right? And also established practices. And like you said, that was kind of the beginning arc of the endurance sports craze here in the U.S. running super popular through the late 70s and into the 80s, and then triathlon kicked in, cycling was getting going, we had the Olympics in 84 and stuff like that. But in a lot of ways, with what you were talking about, you were bucking that current knowledge trend. Did you get a lot of resistance from either existing medical practices or common fueling practices at that time, either from athletes or established prescribers of what to do and the proper things to do when training and competing?
I don't know if it was resistance, Jim, as much as it was just dismissal and, you know, marginalization. You know, I mean, keep in mind, I didn't introduce the first fuel or calories, you know, until 1991. So from 87 to 91, I was only selling coenzyme micronutrient supplements and things like that, while certainly recommending to anybody that would listen that they needed more protein in their diet. But I made the mistake of thinking that I would be a specialist and I would limit my area of expertise, you know, to where it really was in terms of coenzyme and metabolic function, cellular metabolism, mitochondrial activity. The original name of the company, ECAPS, stood for the Coenzyme Athletic Performance System, right? Over time, I think I got a little bit better at naming conventions and branding, you know, so 95, we got Hammer Nutrition and Hammer Gel. But the point was, is, you know, from 87 to 91, I was helping athletes with their energy, endurance, and recovery by having them increase vitamin, mineral, coenzyme, phytonutrient intake, so forth, making the huge mistake of saying, hey, I'm going to leave the energy bars and the energy drinks to those other guys. They've got it all figured out. Well, no, they don't. And they didn't. And when I finally just got so tired of hearing one horror story after another from my clients who had gotten fitter than they ever had in their life, their training, their recovery, everything is going so well because they've upped the protein in their diet, they're taking coenzymes and micronutrients and vitamins and minerals, and they're like, yeah, I'm going to go to Hawaii and I'm going to set the biggest PR in my whole life. Well, after 8 hours on sugar, salt, and citric acid, their day was done.
Yeah.
And they'd be lucky to finish. And they're like, I don't know what happened. I listened to what everybody said. I was consuming 300 or 400 calories an hour. I'm drinking 40, 60 ounces of fluids. I'm taking salt like it's going out of style. And I still cramped up and dehydrated and, you know, didn't finish or barely finished or had a bad day.
Or was throwing up on the side of the road for 45 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, or in the porta potty every mile or two on the run, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all the usual horror stories. And I was just like, you know what? I can't take this anymore. It's not that hard. When you go over 2 hours, what you put in your mouth becomes really, really important. And guess what? The rule book, as there appears to be, and that all these other companies seem to follow, that, you know, a sports drink must contain sugar, salt, and citric acid. In fact, we even have problems in some of the foreign countries, in Norway and Denmark, places like that. They have such specific criteria that our HEAD product, we can't even call it a sports drink, because it has to contain at least 50 grams of sugar per serving, and it has to contain at least 300 milligrams of sodium, and it has to contain this much citric acid, or it's not a sports drink.
Wow.
So we're like, okay, fine. In those countries, this is not a sports drink. Do not use it when you exercise.
That's got to be incredibly frustrating, right? That's got to be incredibly frustrating to think that they're so unaware and uneducated in terms of what is and should be considered a sports drink versus what is promoted in a lot of cases as a sports drink.
Totally, Jim. And, you know, it's also one of those things where, you know, if you go up against an 800 pound gorilla, you're going to lose every time. So, we let these billion-dollar companies continue to promulgate this, you know, misinformation. And the sad part is that a lot of athletes, especially newbies coming into the sport, they think, I'm the only one that this is happening to. I'm the only one that gets sick, that gets stomach upset, the GI distress, and all the usual stuff when they try to do endurance events. I mean, I've met athletes as far away as South Africa who were saying, until I discovered Hammer products, I had given up on trying to exercise for more than 3 hours, because every time it ended with cramps, GI distress, getting sick. And it wasn't until I started using your products and throttling back the volumes to reasonable, sustainable levels that now I'm like, I think this lady I talked to, she just finished a 1,000-kilometer brevet. Or she's, you know, riding 6, 8, 9 hours a day, every day.
Yeah.
With a smile on her face and not a cramp in her body.
Yeah. So 91 becomes a new kind of iteration and development of products. Was that based on more need that you saw in the space, or more like desire from the people you're already working with? Hey, what about a more protein oriented long form energy delivery system? Or what about a proper hydration with electrolytes product? Where was the confluence of the need versus the market opportunity?
It was absolutely the need that I saw, because keep in mind, not only in the late 80s, let's say between 87 and 91, was triathlon and specifically the Ironman distance becoming extremely popular. You had Greg LeMond winning the Tour, you know, and all Masters cycling coming on and huge. And you know, they want to do long road races. People want to do centuries and so forth. So you had this whole phenomena of largely baby boomers deciding that they want to go long. Ultra running, same thing. I mean, when I first started advertising in Ultra Running magazine in 1988, it had a circulation, a subscriber base of 1,500 people. And there was maybe a couple of dozen 100-mile events, probably not even that, maybe a dozen 100-mile events in the whole country.
Yeah.
Now today, you know, they have probably 15,000 subscribers or more, and there's, you know, dozens and dozens of 100-milers, 100Ks, 50Ks. But at that time in the 80s, I mean, if you were going to try to go out and do a 100-mile trail race, what were you going to fuel on? They knew Gatorade didn't work.
Yeah.
And so the aid stations at the original early 100-milers was just like a cornucopia of junk food. I mean, cookies and brownies and pretzels and Skittles and you name it, chicken soup. And I mean, yeah. It was, you know, you could roll into an aid station somewhere in the forest and, you know, have a whole smorgasbord of a meal, because people just didn't know what you're supposed to fuel with, how you're supposed to fuel your body if you're going to be out on trail for 18 to 24 hours.
Yeah. And if you look at the evolution of your product line now, it's a full lineup of supplements, and you recently introduced CBD, which is also, as is well known, to be an amazing product for the body, both in performance and recovery and everything else. As you look back on it, even at this point of your career and the growth of your company, what do you think you're most proud of? What makes you the happiest when you look back on the arc of the development of what is Hammer Nutrition today?
I mean, it's got to be the race caps, you know, the product that's near and dear to me, the first product that I offered, because the funny thing was, is, you know, my dad had discovered coenzyme Q10 back in the early 80s. It was ungodly expensive. You had to buy it from Japan. And we knew from personal experience and from the very initial research that was coming out, the merits that this micronutrient, this coenzyme had. and being dismissed and you know, called a snake oil salesman, and you know, this is all hype and it's all a placebo effect and blah blah blah. And then you fast forward today, 35 years later, coenzyme Q10 is the third most popular over-the-counter supplement in the world. There are thousands upon thousands of studies, meta-analysis, and so forth that confirm that coenzyme Q10 is the miracle nutrient, that it increases cardiac output, stroke volume, it strengthens everything related to the cardiovascular system, and on and on and on. So, you know, there's a little validation there. And when I tell people, you know, I dropped out of college, I started this business largely based on my personal experience and the benefits that I noticed from taking coenzyme Q10 in my athletic exercise career. But in truth, compared to CBD, coenzyme Q10 is a one-trick pony. It's not unimportant. Everybody needs a strong heart and a well-functioning cardiovascular system. But when you look at the myriad benefits that CBD offers, I'm still trying to find a person that wouldn't benefit from it.
Yeah.
And I haven't. And it doesn't matter whether it's in the areas like, you know, recovery, sleep, inflammation, stress, feelings of uneasiness, et cetera, it checks every box.
Yeah.
So I would say it's already been almost 4 years. We introduced our CBD products in August of 2018. So I would say, yeah, I mean, I have that, you know, fondness in my heart for race caps for sure. But the benefit spectrum that I've seen and the things that people are reporting from introducing CBD into their daily routine, it continues to blow me away. And the research that's coming out every day, we're finding a new area of benefit. I'm looking forward to a day when there's a recommended daily allowance for CBD.
Sure.
It's that universal, and it's that void of any negative attributes. It's not habit forming. There's no side effects. But by the same token, the fuels that we've developed in between, Hammer Gel in 95, and again, going back to 91, sustained energy. It was, as far as I can tell, I would love if someone told me if I was wrong, it was absolutely the first sports drink on the market anywhere in the world that contained no citric acid, contained no added flavorings or sweeteners or sugar of any kind, no artificial colors or sweeteners, three forms of complex carbohydrates, and some soy protein. And it changed endurance sports. I know that doesn't sound very humble, but we gave people something finally, a source of calories that would not cause the blood sugar levels to spike and rebound and spike and rebound every 20 to 30 minutes like they do with sugar, and would give them protein to offset the cannibalization that starts occurring after 70, 80 minutes of exercise. You know, you start burning 10 to 20%, 30% of your calories can come from protein, i.e. lean muscle mass. Not a good place to be getting your calorie donation when you're out riding your bike or running on trail. And again, the results that we heard, you know, we were already big into trail running, ultra running, Ironman stuff. And people, the first time they would go out and use the product, they're like, okay, it tastes like soggy Cheerios or wallpaper paste, or all kinds of other not so flattering descriptions. But they were like, first time, no GI distress,
yeah,
no cramps, no side stitches, no gut rot, good energy for 6 hours, 8 hours or more. And I didn't develop that product alone, by the way. One of the first athletes that I ever sponsored in 1987 was Bill Meisner, who was a very talented ultra runner. He did these man versus horse 50-mile runs that were televised on CBS Sports a couple of times. He lost both times. It was kind of like a turtle in the hair thing. But he also, you know, was a kind of a mad scientist and, you know, loved to tinker in the kitchen. And of course, he and I talked extensively from 87 on about the problems with energy drinks and sports drinks and things like that, that people were supposed to be using to fuel themselves when they did 50 mile man versus horse trail races or 100 mile trail races or whatever. So he said, well, I have an idea for a macronutrient formula that's just complex carbohydrates and protein. You know, would you be interested in looking at it? And I said, absolutely, bring it. So he sent that to me and I immediately started using it on my long rides. I was cycling at that time, competing in crits and road races and what. So, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 hour rides were fairly common. And again, same thing, you know, just game changer. And that was when I knew that we had to start offering athletes an alternative to the Gatorade, the sugar, salt, citric acid paradigm. And the company pivoted from strictly selling coenzymes, vitamins, minerals, things like that, to now we have a real sports drink.
But you're not in these days too. And I think the exposure has gotten and the information is out there to where you're not just beholden to the endurance athlete world. You're a big passionate auto and car racing guy and motocross guy and all that. And a lot of these products are, and those guys train endurance sports too. I get it, but you've now transcended the endurance sports world and are working with athletes across the spectrum, right?
Absolutely. I think to me, what it really is more, the case is that in this day and age, life's an endurance sport.
Roger that. Yeah.
Most people are engaging in some form of activity that requires endurance. And so, you know, some people might think that it's a recent kind of pivot or change in terms of the sports and the markets that we're active in. It's not. As I said, I grew up racing motocross. I was racing, you know, at Indian Dunes when I was 5, 6 years old.
I'm surprised. And it would not surprise me at all that to find out that you and I were in some of the same races at Indian Dunes or even Ascot as little guys. I grew up with that smell of two-tone on the Friday nights, and Saturdays were spent at Indian Dunes way out there. So it would not have, would not be shocked at all to find out that we were in a lot of those heats together out there, my friend.
You're not wrong. Yeah, absolutely. If we had Facebook and stuff back then, we probably would have known it.
Or maybe our parents rolled in the same crew back in the day out there too. Who knows? That's funny.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, you know, my mission from the very beginning, from 1987, has been to help athletes to do better at their chosen sport or discipline, you know, and reach their goals. PR in a marathon, you know, crossing the finish line at Ironman, climbing, you know, Mount Everest, whatever it is, you know, I have the background, the experience to be able to help them get where they want to go. And I really enjoy helping people. It's very rewarding. And so this is why I've been at it nonstop for as long as I have, and why I have no intention of quitting anytime soon.
Let's talk a little bit about some specifics and kind of the ups and downs. When you think about an event like the BWR, very challenging, or the seasoned athlete, or even the person just jumping into it as a bucket list item, what are some of the most common mistakes that endurance athletes make in their hydration and fueling strategies during an event?
Good question, Jim. And I, something around 25 years ago or more, I wrote an original article called The 10 Biggest Mistakes Endurance Athletes Make and How to Avoid Them. And from that, we got the 5 Secrets of Success and so many other, basically all of our fueling literature originally came from that. And so running down the list, you know, some of the 10 biggest mistakes are, the first one is overhydrating. Overhydrating in the days before, overhydrating during the event. I always am concerned when I talk to an athlete who's giving me a report of a event they just did and with bad results, you know, and they're saying things like, I drank a lot. Well, how much did you drink? I don't know, a lot. I just kept drinking. I just draining one bottle after another. Uncontrolled fluid intake is really bad. Our body can only absorb a certain amount. And if when we flood it, bad things happen. We flush out our electrolytic minerals prematurely. We upset fluid balance in the body. So the typical situation we see with regard to hydration, and this is one of the five secrets to success, is athletes habitually underhydrating in their daily life, essentially living in a state of dehydration, okay? Because they're not consuming even half an ounce per pound of body weight of fresh water every single day, exclusive from all other sources and what they consume during exercise. And keep in mind, that's a minimum. I want to see people at 3/4 of an ounce per pound of body weight. So, you know, you're usually talking over 100 ounces a day. 80 to 100 ounces for most people, body weight and, you know, size adjusted, is an ideal place to be. Most people we see are consuming about 40, maybe 40 to 60 ounces, if they're honest. And so they live in a state of dehydration, which isn't making things like easy on your body. Muscles don't work as well. Connective tissue is more brittle. Everything, organs are more stressed out. Everything is struggling more in your body when you're dehydrated. Then they say, oh, hey, you know what? I got a hot race on Saturday. So Wednesday or Thursday, I'm going to start loading up. And they, you know, grab that gallon jug and start walking around, you know, and just chug. And essentially probably doubling or tripling their fluid intake overnight. The body doesn't respond well to that. We're not camels. We cannot hold water. So it goes out and you start peeing with increased frequency until your urine is completely clear. And you flushed all of the electrolytes out of your body. I mean, literally, I hear athletes who tried to fluid load cramping up within 30 minutes of the start of their event. Mm-hmm. That's how bad it can be. And I promise you, if, you know, just absent the loading, if a person just would have maintained their normal fluid intake, whatever it was, and gone into the event, they'd had a much better day out there. So as I was saying before, it's that, you know, less is best and not doing too much. So one of the 10 biggest mistakes is overhydrating in the days leading up to an event and during the event. Okay, we know from research, and this is one of these, another area where I have to stop and pause and tell people, listen, everybody is the same. You know, you always hear people saying, well, everybody's different. You got to try and see what works for you. Okay, when it comes to fluid absorption and hydration, no, our bodies are all the same. You might have different size bodies that might affect total fluid absorbed or things like that, but no. The human body, a typical size body, let's say 160-pound male athlete, okay, can absorb no more than 24 to 26 ounces of water per hour. It can't be done. And you can't train your body to absorb more fluid, okay? These are processes in the body that you cannot dictate, that you cannot affect, other than making it worse. So I don't care if it's 120 degrees out there, if you're consistently chugging more than 24 ounces, 26 ounces an hour of water, within a few hours, you're going to experience some consequences.
Yeah.
So what we want to do instead is to practice and try to be effective, good hydrators every day of our life. And I usually try to get people to use a container, you know, either a 32 ounce container that they're going to drain three times a day, mm-hmm. or a 64 ounce jug or whatever they want. But I'm not able to hit my hydration markers on a daily basis if I don't plan it, if I don't set that out. And I start by literally rolling out of bed, brushing my teeth, and drinking 16 ounces of water. No cup of coffee, nothing else until I've drank at least 16 ounces of water.
Yeah, because we wake up dehydrated anyway, just from the night of sleep and the respiration and the sweating and everything that goes on as we sleep. We're already in the hole as soon as we get out of bed.
Totally. So the idea is to try to get your daily fluid amounts, you know, like I said, working your way up to about 3/4 of an ounce per pound of body weight. So for me, I'm at 165 pounds, you know, I'm trying to get 90, 100, 110 ounces a day. And I'm trying to do that between the time I wake up and about 3 hours before bed or dinner time.
So do you enhance that with electrolytes, or do you take care of the electrolytes in your during activity hydration?
Exactly. So what we're talking about in terms of daily fluid intake, this would be exclusive of coffee and tea. This would be exclusive of the two bottles that you drank on your 2 hour bike ride. Okay. This is literally just plain fresh water sitting at a table. If you do that, you're going to be able to withstand short-term bouts of dehydration much, much better. And to your point, Jim, when you're exercising, that's the time when you're expending nutrients, when you're expending electrolytes and fluid, that's the time to replace it effectively. So moving on, one of the 10 biggest mistakes, blowing the hydration paradigm, both before and during. Okay. Second of the 10 biggest mistakes is trying to load calories and trying to consume too many calories while exercising. You know, I don't know about you, but you know, even when I'm at race weight, I still got at least 5-10 pounds of body fat sitting there on my hips and waist, that my body will love to metabolize and use as a fuel source while I'm exercising. Yeah. If I let it.
Yeah.
Okay. So the whole idea of carbo loading, you know, oh yeah, I got a big race on Saturday. So, you know, Thursday and Friday night, I'm going to have like plate after plate of pasta. Again, totally superfluous, totally unnecessary. That might give you an extra 10 minutes of glycogen at the end of the day. All the loading pre-event that your body can do is accomplished just as a result of your taper. Okay. By maintaining constant fluid and calorie intake, but tapering your energy expenditures or your training, I hope people are tapering. I hope they're taking it easy Wednesday, Thursday, Friday before 120-mile gravel ride, because they're not going to get any fitter. I can guarantee you that.
Right.
Right. So they should be resting up, feet on the couch, doing minimal activity. Okay. Well, boom. You've just reduced your caloric expenditures by, you know, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 calories a day. Okay. Your body is storing as much of that as it possibly can. It does not need any help from you storing more,
because if the body's thinking, okay, cool, I you're not stressing me out and forcing me to feed, so I'm going to take what I've got here and hold on to it as my reserves, and I'm good, like I'm ready to go. The body's physically trained for this effort, and now I'm going to rely on the good energy stores that you've already put in me in anticipation of this big effort on the weekend.
Exactly. So the point is, you know, in the days leading up to the event, if you increase caloric intake at all, you're likely just going to be gaining weight. And just your body's just converting that into adipose tissue into fat, which may or may not end up getting metabolized on Saturday or Sunday. But it's counterproductive. It's not helpful.
Yeah.
So we're not loading in the days leading up. We're just maintaining constant fluid and caloric intake. Because after all, Saturday is just another day with a long bike ride. Now that pivots on to how many calories per hour or how many calories do you try to consume in the morning of and during your event? And again, let's talk about less, a lot less. We see people, and even, you know, on some of the websites that have recommendations for what you should do pre-ride, talking about like an 800 to 1200 calorie breakfast an hour or two before you start your event. And then let's consume, now they're down to 200 to 300 calories an hour on the recommendation. It used to be up to 400 or even more on race day because you're going that much harder. And I can tell you right now, Jim, I mean, you've got enough experience and I've tried it, okay? I mean, even maintaining 200 calorie an hour intake, hour over hour for 5 or 6 hours is not fun.
And it's hard. It's honestly hard to do, maybe even made more hard by some of the terrain that these rides are on, right? It's not often easy to reach in your pocket and grab something or even grab your bottle in that case. And there you go. You get it. You're getting a half an hour or 45 minutes or an hour behind in that strategy. And you're just digging a big, big hole.
Yeah. So like I said, the most recent recommendations I've seen from, you know, the registered dietitian nutritionist crowd is 200 to 300 calories an hour without qualification as to your body size. Okay. I mean, if you're a Clydesdale, you know, and you weigh 250 pounds, okay, you might be able to handle 300 calories an hour, but why would you? Why would you want to? My point is this, okay? Instead of trying to think about how can I consume more calories? I want to think about less is best. What's the fewest number of calories I can consume while I'm riding without it slowing me down? Okay, now I've worked my way over the years, again, at 160, 165 pounds, I've worked my way down to 130 calories an hour.
Did I include the hydration, the calories that could come from a hydration bottle, or is that just solid food?
No, that's calories from all sources.
Total. Okay.
Hourly caloric intake is always, I'm always talking about that on a cumulative basis.
Calories that's a calorie.
That's another mistake that people make that you should remind me to discuss, because I've had people go really wrong with their fueling plan because they added a bunch more calories inadvertently because they wanted to change the flavor or something like that. And they didn't realize that, you know, adding 5 servings of Hammer Gel to that thick bottle of Perpetuum that they were planning on drinking for 3 hours just blew their hourly caloric intake out of the water.
Right.
So no, I'm talking about calories from all sources. Now again, can I process 150 comfortably? Yeah, I can do 180 calories an hour. That's about the maximum that I can comfortably consume. But guess what? I don't go any faster. Those 50 calories an hour I'm intaking, I'm not putting out more watts. I'm not going faster. All I'm doing is making more work for my body to process more calories and deal with this stuff that I clearly don't need. So the idea is, in your long training rides and, you know, just on a daily basis, starting to get familiar with this concept of fewer calories per hour until you start seeing watts decreasing or heart rate going up or some indication that it's affecting your pace. Because I don't know about you, but I don't want to drink any more calories than I need to on the bike. I want to have a nice meal when I'm done.
Right. Right.
Okay. So all I want to do is consume enough calories from the time I start pedaling until I stop pedaling to keep me going as fast as I can for, you know, my fitness level and ability and everything.
Yeah.
For me, like I said, it's 130. For most people, I think 150 to 180 calories an hour is going to be the ballpark that they want to play in. Now, if you're talking about a 100-pound, 110-pound female cyclist, you know, they might, they're probably down at 100 calories. They're maybe 120, and they're good. You know, a much bigger person, okay, maybe they do go closer to 200. But I promise you, I've not talked to anybody in decades who's like, yeah, 250 calories an hour, 300 calories an hour for an Ironman or for a, you know, 8 or 12 hour run. That's, it's perfect for me. No, they can do that for an hour or two, maybe. And then they have to stop because their system's getting backed up. They've just got too many calories coming in. Because again, let's talk about another autonomous process here. Liver converting blood sugar, glucose into glycogen, right? Again, you cannot train your liver to produce glycogen faster. Okay, from the minute you're born until the minute you die, that liver, besides being your primary filtering organ, it's trying to convert as much blood glucose into glycogen as it can. And what we've seen is, and what the research says is, it's 1 gram a minute. The liver can convert 1 gram of carbohydrate per minute into usable glycogen. So we know that each gram of carbohydrate is 4 calories. And you got 60 minutes in an hour. So 240 calories an hour is the, your theoretical maximum that the liver can convert. Okay, so consuming any more than that is certainly a bad idea.
It's only going to lead to problems. It's only going to lead to backup in your system, GI distress, overstressing the your system as a whole.
Totally. Totally. Stomach backup, all kinds of things that aren't fun.
Is that where, is it as simple to say as that's where side aches come from? Is that why we get a side ache? Is because I'm either putting too much in my system at a time when I'm trying to exert effort, a hard effort, or even a medium effort, and the stomach and the body just says, hey, hang on, I can only do one of these at a time. I can go really hard over here, or I can start to digest all the stuff you just dumped in the system. One's got to give.
Exactly. More or less. Yeah. Most of your side stitches and stomach discomfort and things like that. Again, marathon runners and trail runners, they learn this a lot faster than cyclists.
Okay? we're not a bright bunch sometimes, that's for sure.
No, it's just because of what's happening. Okay, when you're running, you're bouncing up and down, right? So your stomach is agitating, it's okay. So anybody who runs marathon or runs trail will tell you what happens if they try to eat a sandwich and go for a hard run. They're going to have a stomach ache, they're going to throw up, or something bad's going to happen, so they don't do it. But cyclists, we're sitting in a very fixed position.
Yeah.
So we oftentimes don't, and this is really bad with triathletes that are bent over the bars in a drop position for hours at a time, they don't even realize that their stomach is distended and bloating and backed up and not evacuating. And as they get off the bike and they get in transition, they're like, whoa, I got Santa Claus belly here.
Yep.
And they try to run out of T2 and they get, you know, 100 yards or whatever, and it's all coming up.
Yeah.
So we don't want to get ahead on our calorie or fluid intake because we're going to block the stomach and have it backed up and create more problems. So when we're talking about calories, we want to figure out just enough calories to keep us going, keep blood sugar levels up and glycogen conversion occurring. And in order to really do that well, we need to cover two bases, because not only do we not want to oversaturate the body with calories while we're exercising, but we want to be very, very sure that when we start turning pedals, we are in a metabolic state where the body can burn fat. If we're in the middle of digesting a meal, because we just had a giant meal an hour and a half beforehand, fat burning is not happening. When we are digesting food and insulin levels are up and all of our other hormone levels are elevated, that is not a fat burning state. So this is why we are so pedantic, why we are so adamant about the 3-hour window prior to your competition. And I'll say it very simply. If you do not have 3 full hours to eat and digest a meal before your race starts, don't do it.
You're better off not, right?
You literally are better off going into that event in a fasted state. Because again, in a fasted state, your body will burn fat like crazy.
Yeah.
So we're trying to start every exercise period. And again, if we want to train like we race and race like we train, we should be trying to set up our daily or weekly training rides and things like this the same way. Hey, if I'm going to get on the bike and start turning pedal after work at 5:30, I'm not eating lunch at noon and then trying to have a big snack before I get on the bike. I'm having a protein shake or a food shake or something at noon. And then I'm having my main lunch, my big lunch at between 2 and 2:30. Okay, so on race day, you know, if your gun goes off, if you're going to start pedaling at 8 o'clock in the morning, hey, if you're already going to be up at 4 or 5 a.m., you know, traveling to the event and getting ready and everything, awesome. Have yourself a good, well-rounded breakfast, 500-600 calories, protein, fat, carbs. Think of like a, you know, chicken and rice and vegetables is my favorite pre-race meal, or an avocado sandwich, or any number of options. And then give yourself that full 3 hours to digest. Don't be snacking along the way. Don't be sucking on a sports drink or anything like that. We're trying to get in all those calories and then fast. Consume nothing but water for 3 hours so that meal is out of our stomach. Muscle and liver glycogen levels are topped off and we are ready to start burning fat. Now, the interesting thing is, up until very recently, we haven't been able to numerically document the difference in macronutrient burn, in calories burned or used to produce energy with the different systems. You know, how many calories per hour am I burning of fat when I do it right, when I do the pre-race meal 3 hours beforehand and I consume only complex carbohydrates and protein while I'm exercising, versus the athlete who ate a big meal 2 hours before the start and is consuming sugar while they exercise. That's all changing now. We've teamed up with Dr. Ferguson at Michigan State University that has a new technology, this mask, this respirator that I call it magic, but there's technology that allows them to measure just based on your exhalation the percentages of macronutrients that you're burning, that you're expending in terms of protein, carbs, fat. So we did a quick little A-B study recently with two brothers that are 2 years apart, and very, very similar, obviously DNA, everything is almost the same, body weight, everything is almost the same. They're both race car drivers, they're both crazy fit. You know, they're doing 5 hour, 5:30 half irons, you know, Wow. They're fast, yeah. They're fit.
Yeah.
One of them is following our pre-race meal protocol, is eating my diet, is eating a high protein, high fat, moderate carb diet. The other one is eating the traditional low fat, high carb athlete diet. So we put them on the stress test. We put them on the treadmill with the magic respirator and they do an hour treadmill test. Our fat adapted athlete who ate the pre-race meal 3 hours before and so on and so forth, his macro burn is more or less 60-30-10. 60% fat, 30% carbs, 10% protein. The high carb athlete who is consuming sugar during the test and who's having all kinds of carbs and low fat and everything and eating a meal an hour and a half before they start the test, he's also more or less at 60-30-10. But he's at 60% carbs, 30% protein, 10% fat.
Wow. Total inverse, like almost a complete opposite.
Exactly. And now these guys want to do 24-hour endurance races, very similar to a 24-hour trail race or some other ultra event, or even call it a 12-hour Ironman. Now, if you were going to be doing a 12-hour or a 24-hour event, would you want to be burning 60% of your calories coming from fat or from carbs? Not to mention the 30% protein burn. I mean, that much protein metabolism, that being that catabolic, I mean, the ammonia buildup, all the metabolic waste, the tissue damage, the weakness that's occurring from 30% of your calories being donated from protein, from lean muscle mass, I mean, it's huge.
Yeah.
So this is what we're talking about. It's not just like, oh, I might be a little faster. Oh, I might not get stomach upset. No, it's the difference of, is your body breaking down and literally cannibalizing itself to do this effort? Or is it relatively maintaining normal metabolism, burning fat freely, sparingly burning carbs, and minimizing the amount of muscle mass that's lost? Now, we're going to continue to do more tests because we're going to start introducing protein during the tests and seeing what we can do to even reduce the catabolism and the protein metabolism that's occurring, and a bunch of other ideas. So there's more research coming, but this is complete validation as to the importance of the pre-race meal timing and the type of calories that we want to consume while we're exercising.
Let's talk a little bit about the importance of post-race. I think we all heard or we understand the notion of recovery and its impact not only on our performance, but on everything else, our overall health, our sleep, and everything else. And there's a very specific window that we need to introduce these things into our system after a hard effort or a training, racing, or otherwise. Talk a little bit about that and the, I love Recoverite. I mean, I actually look forward to it during the ride. I can't wait to get home to bust open and have my nice, very good tasting and yummy treat. I look at it as a treat almost for completing the effort. What is the importance of recovery and how does it impact our performance during training and racing?
Absolutely, Jim. Thank you for the intro. And yes, you're not wrong. You know, post-race recovery, I guess, you know, to me, that depends a lot if it's an A, B, or C race. I'll tell you right now, I mean, after next weekend, you know, after Sunday, after I'm done with Nationals on Sunday, my post-race meal on Sunday night, probably not going to be Recoverite.
A but couple of cold beers and a nice, excessive meal, maybe?
Yeah, I might go off the reservation just a little bit. If you remind me, I might tell you what my nasty, nasty treat that I have after a competition, if I win.
Okay.
But the point is recovery on a daily basis, you know, the whole point that for us to engage in daily training is to climb the fitness ladder, right? I'm trying to get fitter than I was last week or last month. And it's a two-step forward, one-step back process. And a lot of times I think people undervalue the recovery component of the whole training process. And I'm oftentimes telling people, hey, I want you to recover as hard as you train. I want you to think about recovery as much as you think about your next workout or your training. Because in my experience, a lot of athletes that are training 5-6 days a week, their so-called recovery day is errand day. That's when they're on their feet all day long, getting all the stuff done that they didn't get done in the week that they were training, and they're going running errands and they're going shopping and they're doing this and that. And I'm like, that's not a recovery day. To me, a recovery day, a true recovery day is you're on the couch.
Yeah.
You got your feet up, you know, you're hydrating, you're, you know, taking macronutrients, you know, you're eating really well. So actionable items. Just like you said, Okay, when you finish a workout, your body, literally the minute you stop turning pedal or running, your body is like the little baby bird when the mom comes to the nest and they're just like mouth open, just feed me, feed me, feed me. Okay, so again, when we talk about survival, okay, your body has just undergone an overreaching effort. Well, it wants to recover from that as quickly as it can in case it needs to do it again real soon. So the window is more or less 3 hours, and it's widest open as soon as you finish exercising. And it closes gradually during that course of 3 hours. As a, for instance, if you consume 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrates in the first 30 to 60 minutes after you finished exercising, you can replenish a large majority of your glycogen stores, 80%-ish, around 12 or 14 hours. If you waited 3 hours to consume those 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrates, now you're talking about well over 24 hours to get back to that 80-85% muscle liver glycogen level. Okay, well, if it's 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night, and you want to go exercise the next morning, 12 hours later, you better have gotten that recovery started as soon as you finished that workout that night. So this is where a product like the Recoverite, for me, is a not a standalone. It's not the only thing that somebody should do for recovery, but it's a really nice bridge to get you across the gap from when you finish exercising until you would normally sit down to a meal. Most of us are, you know, either we're hanging out with people and chit-chatting after we finish our ride, or we got to load up and drive home. For one reason or another, it seems like most athletes, if they're not doing something like, you know, having that Recoverite in the van when they're waiting for them when they get back, they're usually waiting an hour to an hour and a half. Best case scenario, sometimes even more, before they get to that recovery meal. So that's where, you know, again, if you can time it so that you're finishing a ride or a workout and within 30 minutes you're sitting down to a hot meal, to a lunch or a dinner, cool. You might not need to even bother with the Recoverite. But timely introduction of macronutrients, of carbohydrates, protein and fat, electrolytes, as soon as you finish a workout is of paramount importance. The other aspect of recovery that is oftentimes neglected is total daily protein intake. Converse to what we were talking about in the beginning of the discussion and what was conventional wisdom in the 80s, endurance training, high volume and aerobic endurance training athletes, their protein requirements are actually quite high. They're actually similar to a strength training athlete, because even though they're not trying to elicit hypertrophy or muscle growth, we're constantly breaking down our muscle tissue and needing it to be repaired to do it again. So we talked numbers earlier with hydration. Same thing is true with protein. A baseline minimum for your daily protein needs is a half a gram per pound of body weight. That's just to service what you've got, okay, and rebuild that tissue that was broken down from your ride or run. So again, for me at 165 pounds, I'm talking 80 grams, 80, 90 grams a day. That's the minimum. Literally, that's the minimum amount of protein that I should be taking in each day and not experiencing delayed recovery or muscle dysfunction. Now, if I'm training really hard and or I'm actually, you know, doing strength training and wanting to grow more muscle mass through hypertrophy, then we kick it up to 3/4 of a gram a day. Okay, so again, the average male athlete, cyclist, should be consuming between 80 and 120 grams of protein a day.
Does your body care
when we do diet?
Does your body care where that comes from? Does it matter if it's vegetable protein, animal protein, or, you know, otherwise? For those of us that don't eat meat, we focus mostly on fish and things like that. body doesn't mind, right?
All protein sources are not equal.
Okay.
And you know, plant-based diet athletes are going to definitely be more challenged in this way. But you also got to remember that, you know, avocados and nuts and even vegetables can be good sources of protein. My point is whether you're plant-based, whether you're vegetarian and you allow yourself, you know, things like eggs and cheese, whether you're ovo-pescatarian, whatever, or whether you're just full on carnivore. My point is that without making a conscious effort every single day, you're not going to get there. Just like I was saying, when most athletes I come into contact with consuming on average 40 to 60 ounces of water a day, most athletes that I come into contact with are consuming less than 60 grams of protein a day. They don't always have protein at breakfast. Sometimes they have it at lunch. Normally it's just, you know, a larger serving of protein at dinner. And so my point is if you want to get to 80, 90 grams a day, you got to think about protein. And again, there's too many diet variations to make specific recommendations. But again, you should have breakfast that includes real protein. Again, that can be bacon and eggs. That can be avocado and hummus on toast. That can be a lot of different things. Your mid-morning snack, your afternoon snacks, think about protein. Again, handfuls of raw nuts with an apple, you know, avocados just cut in half with a little olive oil and lemon juice inside where the pit was. I mean, you name it, think about it, you know, make yourself a list of all the protein that you love to eat and focus on it. My diet starts with protein and builds from there. So protein on a daily basis, you got to be getting it in your normal diet. Now, again, there are protein supplements. A lot of people find it easier just to do a serving of plant-based or whey protein or something a day. You're normally getting about 20 grams per serving. So let's say that that athlete who is getting 60 grams a day and they like their diet and they don't want to go protein heavy. Okay, fine. Keep eating what you were eating and keep getting 60 grams a day from your regular meal. And then take one serving of whey protein or plant protein a day. As long as you get there, I'm not really concerned with how you do it. But I can tell you right now, if you want to improve your recovery, and especially muscular recovery, get serious about your protein intake every day. Not just on race day or after race day, but you know, Monday through Friday, 7 days a week. Eat protein.
Love it. You are, and your products are the main reason why we want to be associated with Hammer and have it at the Belgian Waffle Ride. It's a tough, challenging ride, and there's nothing better out there that we would want to have at all of our aid stations. So I want to thank you upfront for your great support of our events. We got Steve coming out to San Diego, and we're going to do a session with him at the expo. He's a tremendous resource and is so knowledgeable and well-spoken. I'm looking forward already to sitting down with him and having everybody there learn from him in terms of the strategies that expanding on what we talked about today. So thank you for that. And thank you for your great support of the event.
No worries, Jim. We're super happy to be with you guys. Again, if an event is long, if it's hard, if it's challenging, that's where Hammer products are going to shine. That's where we want to be. I know we're already going on 75 minutes, but if you've got another 5 to 7 minutes,
brother, I got the time. Let's really do it. Need yeah.
to hit on. All right. So let's hit on electrolytes and sodium,
please. Yeah.
Because that is the third, that's the trifecta in the misunderstood mythology of fueling.
Well, and this is, I'm selfish here because I struggle with that too. I'm a very heavy, salty sweater. And if only for me, let's hit this.
Right on. So without further ado, again, we hear people saying, you know, oh, you know, some, you just said it in your own words, you're a heavy, salty sweater. And I actually find, I've heard experts, learned, educated people saying things like, well, you know, you can do a sweat study and see, because some people are just salty sweaters and some are not. And this is where I scratch my head and I'm like, wait, you guys, can we back it up just a little bit? Because coming from my background, coming from my holistic background, and from what we know from all of the research that's been done on sodium, it isn't just like if some is good, more is better. And this is another area where people are not different, okay? Every human being is the same when it comes to the way their body processes and deals with sodium. And here's the thing. We don't manufacture sodium or chloride in our body, okay? We only get it from external sources, right? So we need to let that set in for a minute and really think that through. If not every athlete perspires at the same rate, and not every athlete shows the same rate of sodium concentration in that perspiration, what is going on here? What is different? And I will tell you, it's so simple. It's right in front of your eyes. It's what you eat. So literally, you know, back in the 50s, 60s, somebody at IBM coined this term, GIGO. Garbage in, garbage out.
Right.
And the idea was, in computing terms, back, if you put in bad data, you get bad data out.
Right.
So I like to use that analogy because it literally, your perspiration rate and your sodium concentration rate is simply a symptom or an outcome of your dietary habits. So we know from all the research that's been done, and there have been thousands of studies. Again, go to the American Heart Association website, read all you want about the effects of high sodium diets on the human body over long terms. Hypertension, heart disease, almost every major disease we have in this country is caused by or exacerbated by high sodium intake. We also know that the American Heart Association has, in the last several years, even further lowered the daily recommended allowance of sodium to not contribute to heart disease or hypertension. And yet, so many experts and other companies would have us believe that just because we want to go out and ride our bikes in the heat for 5 or 6 hours, or we do that with some regularity, that we now have a pass and sodium is our friend and the more the better. Load up on it. I know of a company in Colorado that specific sodium loading formula, I think it's like 1700 milligrams of sodium chloride per serving. And they're telling you to take one or two of those in the days leading up to your event. Again, I hate to break it to everybody, but we can't load sodium. Our body does not like to have too much sodium in it. When we get sodium delivered to our manufacturing facilities, it comes in drums with hazmat markings on it. Okay, skull and crossbones. This stuff is caustic because if you ate too much of it, you would die. Okay, so we have to be very serious and very intentional about our sodium intake on a daily basis. The American College of Sports Medicine, I believe, is also in compliance, is also congruent with the American Heart Association now in recommending between 2,300 and 3,500 milligrams a day of total sodium chloride intake. The standard American diet typically produces 8,000 to 12,000 milligrams. And if a person is freely consuming sodium-rich foods, beef jerky, potato chips, pickles, you name it, they can be at 15 grams a day. They can be at 15,000 milligrams a day without even trying.
Yeah.
Now that's going to be that person, when they go to exercise in the heat, they are going to be a perspiring, salt crusty mess. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to try to tell anybody, you included, that you've got to redo your diet and you've got to get rid of all the sodium or you won't be able to do well on Saturday. Not at all. What I want you to do is I want you to be honest with yourself, okay? Because there's nobody else in the room. If you eat a high sodium diet, you must practice high sodium replacement during exercise. If you eat a low sodium diet, you will likely be able to practice low sodium replacement when you exercise. So the question is next that comes next is, okay, I'm not changing my diet. I show signs of sodium excess, high sweat rate, crust building up on my skin, helmet strap clothing. What do I do? Okay, well, you want to make friends with Enduralyte's Extreme in the powder and the capsule form. It's got 300 milligrams of sodium chloride per capsule or per scoop. And you will likely need to consume between 600 and 1200 milligrams per hour to avoid cramping. That's a lot more than you should. We think normally for a well-adapted athlete eating a low sodium diet, 200 to 300 milligrams an hour of sodium chloride intake should allow them to maintain electrolyte balance, even in extreme heat stress situations. But my point is just, again, to reiterate, know who you are and practice electrolyte replacement that is appropriate for your dietary habits. Okay, so if you're out there riding and like you said, you struggled with, you struggle with cramps and with, heat stress affectations, I would probably be putting like one or two scoops of Enduralyte's Extreme powder in each of your water bottles or fuel bottles. And then I would be carrying a capsule dispenser with a half a dozen to a dozen more Enduralyte's Extreme capsules in a jersey pocket. And I would consume those at a rate of about one of every 30 to 60 minutes, depending on heat stress and how you're feeling. The last thing is no one should ever cramp when they have electrolytes on board. I mean, if you just run out of Enduralytes and you got nothing else and you're out there drinking water and you cramp up, okay, fine. But if you have electrolytes on board, you got to take more. I don't care how many you've been taking up until now. And you probably know very well how the muscles will start to misfire, start fibrillating a little bit, start tightening before the cramp comes.
Yeah.
Okay. That's your sign. If that starts happening, I don't care how many electrolytes you've taken. I don't care how much you've done up until now. It's time to take more right now, literally. Do not turn another pedal stroke before you reach back and grab another Enduralyte and pop it and swallow it. Normally within 3 to 5 minutes, instead of progressing into a full blown cramp, the muscle will relax and start firing properly again. And then last thing I'll say is in closing on the sodium topic, again, going back to Dr. Ferguson and the magic respirator mask that he has at Michigan State University in their human performance lab, another guy that we're working with in the race car world that has a sweat patch technology that allows, it's called CoreSight, and this sweat patch measures fluid volume and perspiration concentration in athletes while they're exercising in real time. And it just so happened that we were able to have pre-test and post-test data on just one athlete who started out in 2017, the first time he did the sweat patches. Again, like you, massive sweat rate, extreme sodium concentration. I rebuilt his diet. He's again very committed to the craft. He's willing to do whatever it takes to be a success. And so he said, okay, well, everything I've been doing up until now, eating ever more sodium, drinking ever more water, is not working. So I'll give it a try. So we went to low sodium diet. He went from 10,000 milligrams a day to 3,000 milligrams a day, more or less, in his daily diet. And then we did the sweat patch test again in January of 2021, I believe it was. And the pre-test data and the post-test data, he recorded about a 30% reduction in sweat rate. And I believe it was a 25% reduction in sodium concentration. And he now reports that, you know, he's able to do half Ironman triathlon, no cramping, no issues. He's super strong in the car, driving extra stints, because he's not losing so much fluid and so much sodium when he's exercising. And my point here is that, yes, you can change. A person who is eating a high sodium diet and experiencing high fluid loss and high sodium loss during exercise, if they really want to, they can remake their diet, cut out all of the excess sodium sources, get to a level of 3,000 milligrams a day or so, and then they'll notice their sweat rate decreasing massively and their sodium concentration decreasing. But as I said, I'm not saying that's the only key to success. What I'm saying is, like I said in the beginning, know who you are and practice electrolyte replacement at the time of expenditure, not before. At the time of loss, replace in amounts that allow you to not cramp up and not have other symptoms of electrolyte imbalance.
All of this is so fascinating. We could go, and I feel like we're just kind of skimming across the top on, in terms of a lot of these things. I would love to have you back as we get through our season and get through the year here. And maybe we take each one of these topics, supplementation, recovery, hydration, nutrition, all these, and maybe go a little deeper into each one of these, because any athlete can benefit from this information and the science that you have, and certainly the wonderful products that you have to back it all up. So I want to thank you. I think it's so interesting, and it's so important, not just in our daily life and our daily health, but certainly if we expect to achieve any level of success in our performance. We've talked a lot of talk, and I know you're a walk the walk guy too. What are you competing in? What Masters event are you competing in this weekend? And what's this tasty treat you're going to afford yourself when you win?
I got a little bit too old for my speed to continue racing motocross, because I just turned 55 on March 10th. And so a couple years ago, I got involved in motorcycle trials, observe trials.
Okay.
It's all skill and balance, right, over the obstacles, rocks and things. You're trying not to put your feet down. It's so technical. It's so all-consuming. The mental aspect of it is really just what I really am enjoying. It's so hard to master these skills. I'm competing in NATC Moto Trials Nationals. There's 8 rounds this year. The first 2 are in Tennessee this next weekend. And I'm not actually competing in a master's class.
Because the open class.
The SR50 class is a lot of former professionals that are on their way back down the ladder because of the skill, the obstacles, and the, you know, danger involved in riding expert or pro. So I'm just riding straight sportsman. There's 15 guys in the class, ranging probably, I'll probably definitely be one of the oldest people, guys in their 20s, 30s, 40s, but at least hopefully we're all in the same upward trajectory on our skill and ability level. But observe trials is amazing because it's, again, the mental focus, the acuity. And again, the brain only runs on glycogen. So you can't be burning fat and concentrating hard. So you have both the muscular endurance and the physical endurance of riding a motorcycle and navigating for hours. But you also have to maintain optimal brain function, because as soon as mental acuity drops even a little bit, you're making mistakes. So at any rate, there's like, there's five categories. You've got clubman, sportsman, expert, and pro. So I'm in the second category from the bottom. I'm in sportsman, and my goal is to make it up one more category to expert sportsman, because anything above that is just too much risk and not enough reward. So anyways, you guys, and my, okay, here it is. Here you go. My post race win treat is go to a gas station and get one of those corn dogs out of the rotisserie case thing. Yeah.
It's been cooking for like 6 or 7 hours and sitting there all day.
Yeah. Who knows where it came from, but that, right? I say, that's right. My, but back in the day when I was in high school racing motocross, we used to go out the 22 to Saddleback to race. And then on the way back, you pull off at the Magnolia exit and go to In-N-Out.
Yeah.
And so my, literally, if I won one or more classes at Saddleback, then it was two double doubles animal style, French fries animal style, and a chocolate vanilla milkshake.
Nice.
But I was in high school.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I know now. So I've modified it to just the one corn dog. So at any rate, so yeah, I'll eat two or three corn dogs a year. If I'm lucky, because it means I won something.
Well, I was going to say, I think maybe this year you're going to have a whole lot more because there's more of those top step podium events for you, man.
I don't know. There's some pretty good guys out there that have been riding this, doing this trials for, you know, their whole life. And I've only been at it for a couple of years. But like I say, the challenge of just being able to navigate a corner, an off camber bottom turn, loose soil and stuff without putting your foot down. To me, that's, I geek out on that way more than like launching up some big rock or something.
Right. My man, good luck. And thank you again. We appreciate the great support from Hammer. Certainly the great knowledge and education. And I admire just your passion and everything that you do to put into your products and just certainly how well they work. But we love having Hammer as part, a big, big part of the BWR experience. So thank you very much, man.
Right on, Jim. Hey, thank you so much for all the love. You know, you and Phil and Michael put on awesome events. BWR is a fixture as far as I'm concerned, you know, and we're really stoked to be a part of it and looking forward to, you know, seeing more people cross those finish lines with smiles on their face and not a cramp or a, you know, side stitch or anything to report. And if anybody listens to this podcast and they want to hear more, you know, tell them to give you that feedback and we'll make it happen.
All right. We'll do that, buddy. Thanks for spending time with us. And maybe we'll get with you out here one of these days for a BWR event.
I might just do that.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Appreciate your time, buddy.
Thank you. See you. Bye.
Some great stuff in there. And we very much appreciate Brian sitting down and taking the time to chat with us. And thank you too for tuning in to this episode and many more to come down the road here as we get through the 2022 BWR season. There's still plenty of time to register for all of our events. You can check out all those details and see in-depth info on all of the courses and the events coming up. BelgianWaffleRide.bike is the place to go. Also love it if you followed us on all the socials to keep up with everything that we got going on. Thanks again for tuning in, and we will see you out on the road.